right, welcome to Worldwise. This is DJ Scrappy. If you're tuning in to me here today, it's Friday, 11 a.m. And here on Worldwise, we discuss issues in science, the environment, and technology affecting California, the Bay Area, and beyond here on Penguin Radio. So my first story that I'm going to present to you today has to do with the arsenic levels in the drinking water of Andean peoples. A little bit later on, we're going to move on to a probe, NASA's probe, that reached Ceres, the asteroid, not too long ago. Then from there, we're going to move on to the food from Fukushima and if it's safe to eat. Then Bill Nye and his changes, or how he changed his views on GMOs. Later on, we're going to look at Ethiopia and new fossil records, finding the first human ever found. And then we're going to go on to quantum device computers. So first up, from the AP, we have a story about the drinking water for Andean people by Anthony Rivas. High levels of arsenic in the drinking water foster genetic tolerance. As you know, arsenic is a pretty lethal poison, and it's been used since the Middle Ages, basically because it's odorless, it's tasteless, and soon after the person is dead. But arsenic, as we know it, it's a metallic element, and it has a reputation over the years with its portrayal on films and TV shows. And while all of us drink it in minuscule doses that are regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency, we might want to leave the higher doses for a population of Argentinians living up in the Andes Mountains. That's because they've actually adapted to its toxic effects. Those were the findings of a new study published in the journal Molecular Biology and Evolution and conducted by scientists at the Karolinska Institute and Uppsala University in Sweden. It found that over thousands of years, they were able to genetically adapt to exposure to higher levels of the toxic element. The people live in the Puna region of the northern Argentinian Andes Mountains, an arid region with little industrial or traffic pollution. Karen Broberg of the Institute of Environmental Medicine at the Karolinska Institute told Medical Daily in an email, "In some areas of the region, arsenic in the volcanic bedrock is released into the groundwater that is used for drinking purposes by the people living in the area. It's common all over the world for arsenic to appear in drinking water. In the U.S., major sources of arsenic include erosion from natural deposits, such as sediment, mineral ores, and coal. Runoff from orchards and runoff from glass and electronic production waste, So it's common for arsenic to be in a drinking water. It's from coal, runoff, orchards, production waste. However, water treatment plants are required to remove arsenic to levels that are 0.010 micrograms per liter or less, which is called a maximum containment level, or MCL. Anything higher than that, and over time the person's drinking water is in risk of skin damage, such as lesions, as well as digestive problems, nerve damage, high blood pressure, shock, and eventually death. Some studies have shown it can also raise a person's risk of developing lung cancer. Broberg said the Andean people's exposure to arsenic was about 20 times higher than the EPA's MCL. For their study, however, they found that these people could tolerate such high levels of exposure because their very DNA adapted to accommodate it. Specifically, after studying the genome of a group of 124 Andean women with the ability to metabolize arsenic, screened for through urine samples, they found variants in the gene AS3MT, which plays a role in metabolism. When these variants were compared to the AS3MT genes among control populations in Colombia and Peru, the researchers found they appeared less often. The researchers suspect that these variants began to spread throughout the population sometime between 10,000 and 7,000 years ago, as that's about the time from which a recently excavated mummy, whose hair contained high levels of arsenic, came. They also said in a press release that these adaptations could have developed out of a need to protect the lives of those most vulnerable to the toxic effects, children and those in their reproductive prime. We know that many genes that metabolize toxins in the body show gene sequence variation when comparing populations from different parts of the world, suggesting that they have locally adapted to cope with different toxins, Broberg said. So it's pretty interesting that they had a groundwater problem with arsenic, and that just over time, evolution has come and found a way to fix that. This is Worldwise. I'm DJ Scrappy. You're listening to radio.dominican.edu. I'm coming to you live from the campus at Dominican University of California here in San Rafael. My next story that I have for you comes from NPR. It's from Geoff Brumfield. There's a NASA probe that has just reached around a dwarf planet named Ceres. And it just entered the orbit of this little world, which is actually between Mars and Jupiter. Around 1801, the Italian monk Giuseppe Piazzi was looking for it and discovered it. Carol Raymond at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in California and the deputy principal investigator of NASA's Dawn mission, which spent 7 years getting to Ceres, has spent a lot of time researching Ceres. Scientists have had a tough time figuring out what to make of Ceres. Right after it was discovered, Ceres was believed to be a missing planet they were looking for. But then astronomers noticed chunks of rock and ice orbiting in the same region. Ceres, it turns out, was actually in the middle of what we now call the asteroid belt. And so then Ceres was referred to as an asteroid, Raymond says. It stayed that way until 2006, when the International Astronomical Union redesigned Ceres, redesignated Ceres, and as well as Pluto, more controversially, as dwarf planets. Ceres got the title because it's bigger and rounder than any asteroid. Personally, Raymond still likes to think of Ceres as a planet. But she admits it occupies a funny sort of in-between place in our planetary system. You know, in the end, it doesn't really matter if it's called a dwarf planet or an asteroid, but we want to understand it, says Raymond. Astronomers think Ceres is a remnant from the earliest days of the solar system. Ceres was gradually becoming larger as its gravity pulled in dust and rock, but since it's so close to Jupiter, Jupiter's gravity actually sent a lot of that rock and dust into space, and stopped Ceres from growing past its present size. But even before the Dawn spacecraft arrived, it provided astronomers with plenty to look at. Back in February, it detected two bright spots on Ceres, which became pretty popular on the internet. Some scientists believe that they were ice volcanoes reflecting back, but Raymond thinks it has more to do with a likely explanation of salt. Dawn won't be landing on the dwarf planet, but it will be staying in its orbit. Raymond says the long wait to get to Ceres means there will be some celebrating today. I think champagne might be nice, she says. But not too much, because there is a lot of work to be done in order to learn how Ceres fits into our solar system. All right, you're listening to Worldwise. I'm DJ Scrappy here at radio.dominican.edu, and we'll be right back with some more.
just met you just the other day. Everything started flowing my way. I just love you.
All right, we're back here on Worldwise. This is DJ Scrappy here at radio.dominican.edu. A little bit ago, we talked about the NASA Dawn spacecraft that just reached around Ceres, and then we went on to talk about arsenic in the genetic code for Andean peoples. Right now, we're moving on to a story about March Madness. Now, it's not the March Madness that you're familiar with. This is called Mammal March Madness, and this story comes from us through the Harvard Gazette. Chances are you've never thought much about whether an orca or a pack of hyenas would win in a fight, but Katie Hind has. An assistant professor of human evolutionary biology, Hind is also the creator of Mammal March Madness, an annual NCAA basketball-style tournament that pits mammalian species against each other in simulated combat. And last year's tournament ended with the orca-hyena face-off, which the hyenas won in something of an upset. This year's bracket features divisions made up of mighty mini mammals, mythical mammals, critically endangered mammals, and sexy beasts, specifically species shaped by sexual selection. The competition will begin on March 9th with a bout between the pygmy jerboa and bumblebee bat. So participants are now researching each species before making their picks. The competition is fun and games, but there's serious science behind it. Hine and her co-organizer, Christy Luton, assistant professor at Boston University School of Medicine, Josh Drew, lecturer at Columbia University, and Christopher Anderson, assistant professor at Dominican University, religiously research each species, and outcome of each match is based on a host of attributes, including temperament, size, weaponry, defensive mechanisms, and habitat. These are the most rigorous fake animal battles you will ever encounter, Hind said. Our preparations are basically biology boot camp. I read hundreds of research articles about the different animals, their natural history, their environment, their adaptations, and their interactions with other animals. And we calculate the probability of the outcome for each bout. I primarily study monkeys, so this is an amazing opportunity to think more broadly about the animal kingdom and share that awesomeness with others. While that scientific rigor can make the contest more genuine, it also demands some creativity from organizers. In last year's tournament, Hind said, one bout saw a binturong, also known as a bearcat, come up against a dhole, a canid species native to Central and Southeast Asia, I believe they're mostly in Tibet. Anyways, despite having only a 5% chance of winning, the team's randomization program showed the binturong coming out on top. We had to find a justifiable reason, grounded in natural history research, publications, to explain the outcome, Hind said, and I ended up reading about how long it takes different canid species to digest their food, and was able to show, since the dhole had won its battle the day before, it was so full it wasn't motivated to fight the binturong. In another case, Hind said, only days before a battle involving a pangolin, research was published showing it to be the most trafficked animal species on the planet. In that case, the battle ended before it began, with a pangolin being captured by poachers and shipped to Asia. The idea for the competition grew out of Hind's love for the NCAA basketball tournament. When I was an undergrad, we would skip 2 days of classes to watch the first round of the tournament, she said. My roommate and I would put our brackets on the wall, and we'd make fun of each other's teams. And we had this camaraderie and fun around the whole thing. The idea for animal competition came 2 years ago, when Hind stumbled onto a blog post that pitted species against each other to determine which was cutest. I said, there's no way I want to do this, so I went to my office and pulled down my encyclopedia of mammals and made up my own bracket. I put it online, thinking that maybe my mom would play, and it just exploded. I had a research trip planned for the Kalahari, and when I got to the field site, the internet would only work in the middle of the night, so I'd stay up until 2 a.m. live-tweeting the battles and then follow meerkats during the day. Hines said that she tries to include an unexpected twist each year to make the competition interesting. This year, in addition to a bracket dedicated to smaller mammals, the competition will include mythical creatures, including the unicorn, Pegasus, the water horse, and the Yeti. Part of this is to hopefully get more classicists to play the game, Hines said, but this is also a chance to talk about different aspects of the human mind, and how we are adapted to think about mythical creatures. As I was researching this, I found that many cultures through human history have included wolf creatures or horse creatures because the mythology is largely built around animals that are dangerous or important to them. In the end, Hein hopes that that those who participate have fun and learn something about species that they might not have known even existed. People get really excited to find out how we play things out, she said. It's a very active spectator sport. As things are happening, I can usually see people tweeting about it, how nervous they are or how excited they are. It's so much fun to see, and I look forward to it all. So you can download your Mammal March Madness bracket at Hein's blog. The results of each match will be revealed via Twitter. So you can follow along at hashtag 2015MMM. That's three M's for Mammal March Madness. And again, you're listening to radio.dominican.edu. I am DJ Scrappy. You're listening to Worldwise, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. This is DJ Scrappy. You're listening to Worldwise here on radio.dominican.edu. If you were just with us, we were going over the NASA probe Dawn spacecraft that just reached the asteroid Ceres. And we also talked about arsenic in our genes, Andean peoples and their ability to cope with arsenic in their drinking water. Now I'd like to talk to you about the food that's being grown in the Fukushima area. After Fukushima suffered the world's worst nuclear meltdown since Chernobyl nearly 3 years ago, Japanese government officials say the region's food is safe to eat. Problem is, neither its producers nor consumers trust them anymore. While not quite the proverbial breadbasket of Japan, Fukushima was, for a long time, home to the nation's fourth largest farming area, and has long supported itself through the production of rice, fruits, vegetables, tobacco, and silk. In addition to a hefty supply of fish and seafood fetched from its 100-mile coastline. Since the meltdown, Fukushima has dropped from the nation's fourth largest rice producer to its seventh, with production reportedly slipping 17%. According to the Agricultural Ministry, roughly 100,000 farmers have lost an estimated 105 billion yen. That's about $1 billion American. Livestock farming once thrived in Fukushima until most of its farmers were forced to evacuate after the meltdown, and 5,000 cattle were ordered slaughtered, and the rest were left to starve to death. At a testy meeting last fall between government and representatives and farmers from Sukugawa and Soma, two of Fukushima's largest food-producing areas, one Sukugawa farmer noted that the government approves of shipments of food that test below 100 becquerels. A becquerel is a unit of radioactivity per kilogram, so that's one below 100, lower than its original 500 BQ limit, which is in line with global standards, selling it at below market value. But he would not allow his own family to eat the food he is allowed to sell. "We won't eat it ourselves, but you tell us to sell it to others. Do you know how guilty this makes us feel? There is no pride or joy in our work anymore." But despite the gut instinct that food from Fukushima cannot be safe, prominent scientists back up the government, with some noting that early evacuations, land restriction, and decontamination efforts, together with Japan's natural iodine-rich seafood diet, make Fukushima's food today safer than an average CT scan. Which I can believe. CT scans have been known to be, you know, a little bit unnecessary if you don't need them. Anyways, back to the story. The real culprit of Fukushima's agricultural industry woes may be what most Japanese consider egregious government lies and obfuscation. Tight-lipped secrecy around its data and laughably low-tech decontamination strategies that don't seem like a match for nuclear contamination. And compounding the problem is that some scientists agree the data isn't good. Nancy Faust, a U.S.-based researcher and technology and communication specialist with simplyinfo.org, a multidisciplinary U.S.-based research group monitoring the Fukushima decontamination efforts, says, "We have found efforts to decontaminate rice paddies, but hard data on things like before and after crops have been hard to come by. The decontamination techniques so far have involved either deep tilling to shove the topsoil down deep, or mixing in potassium to try to prevent the plants from taking up cesium." And that's the rub. Most of the techniques employed in Japan, ranging from soil scraping to tilling to power blasting the bark off fruit trees, or water sweeping with karchers, which are high-pressure, industrial-strength cleaning machines, are primitive at best, near replicas of strategies used in Chernobyl nearly 30 years ago. Worse, the results of such efforts are often kept secret, or at least oblique, by the government officials overseeing them. "All of our requests for disclosure have been rejected," says Nobuyoshi Ito, a rice farmer in Iyadate, and former systems engineer who has emerged as a widely cited grassroots expert on decontamination. He has been conducting his own tests with Geiger counters and other equipment to compare results with government figures, sending them to a laboratory in Shizuoka Prefecture for confirmation. Even the Ministry of the Environment, the ones who actually lead the decontamination work, are unclear or at a loss for specifically quantify their assessments. When we ask them about the possible reduction of the rate of radiation, they answer, "We won't know until we try," according to Ito. The government keeps kicking the can down the road, refusing to publicly release its findings, claiming that they are still in progress. If rice and produce are hard to assess, fish and seafood pose an even bigger challenge. Marine creatures are always on the move, following tides and currents. Some fish in one area of the sea are contaminated and others aren't, says Faust. They're having better luck focusing on certain breeds of bottom feeders. Rockfish, for example, almost always show levels of contamination, though it's usually pretty low. They're reliable, but they don't show the extremes. The government botched this test as well, says Faust, displaying samples with octopi, which typically has low levels to claim all seafood was safe. While natural iodine from some seafood helps cancel out the radioactive iodine in fast-moving fish, using octopi as a standard misrepresents localized risk. No one was fooled, further eroding the trust of the government. So the fear of Fukushima's food persists, and Geraldine Thomas, a professor of molecular pathology at the Imperial College in London and the scientific director of the Chernobyl Tissue Bank, was asked to assess likely health effects from Fukushima after her extensive work on thyroid cancer cases in Russia. Thomas finds the food fear in Japan baffling, a sign of modern and misbegotten hysteria. The most important thing to do immediately after the accident was to restrict the consumption of locally produced milk and green leafy vegetables, which are known to concentrate radioactive iodine. She says, as opposed to the healthy natural iodine found in some seafood. This, the Japanese government did very well, in contrast to the Soviet authorities following the Chernobyl accident. The Japanese continue to monitor foodstuffs, and they have imposed even stricter limits on radiation in foodstuffs from Fukushima Prefecture than we have found for our own produce in the United States and in the UK. Dr. Ian Fairley, an independent consultant on radioactivity in the environment who is closely monitoring Fukushima, says that Japanese should fear radiation, just not necessarily in the region's food. Contaminated food intakes are a relatively small part of the problem. People near Fukushima are more exposed via direct radiation, which is called ground shine. Smaller doses also come from water intake and from natural inhalation. The professor also adds, both the World Health Organization and the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Atomic Radiation agree that the biggest threat to health post-Fukushima is the fear of radiation, not the radiation itself. Personally, I would have no worries about consuming food from Fukushima, and in fact did so when I was in Tokyo last April. So what I gather from this is a little bit of radiation really isn't that bad. In fact, if you live in a higher altitude, say if you lived in Denver, the Mile High City, you're actually exposed to more radiation than if you lived, I don't know, somewhere near Death Valley. So, you know, mind your P's and Q's, or your Beck tools. Anyways, this is DJ Scrappy, and you're listening to Worldwise here on radio.dominican.edu. We just went over the Fukushima accident, and if the food there is safe to eat. Next up, we're going to be talking about Bill Nye and how he's changed his mind about GMOs. More to come here on Worldwise.
Oh,
Welcome back to Worldwise. This is DJ Scrappy, and you're listening to radio.dominican.edu. If you were with us earlier, we went over the NASA probe, the Dawn spacecraft, which just reached its orbit around Ceres. Then we went on to Mammal March Madness. It's a play on, you know, NCAA basketball. Then we also talked about the arsenic and Indian people's DNA. Anyways, let's move on, shall we? Let's talk about Bill Nye. And if you don't know who Bill Nye is, you know, he's Bill Nye the Science Guy. He had his own show on for a while. And if you took any science classes in America in the last 20 years, then you have seen his show. In fact, I got to meet Bill Nye. I grew up around Chicago, and he worked at the particle accelerator that we have over there in Fermi Labs, and my science teacher is actually a buddy of his, so we got to go say hi. But Bill Nye has been a little bit outspoken in the past about GMOs. He's been very skeptical about it, but maybe now he's changed his mind. From the Washington Post, we have this story. He's not making his popular children's science show anymore, but Bill Nye, the Science Guy, is still making a public impact by going after pseudoscience and science denial. He's railed against the idea of teaching creationism in public schools, and he's come to the defense of climate science and vaccines. But on another hot-button issue involving science, genetically modified organisms, Nye has actually angered many scientists. Over the years, including in a chapter in his 2014 book, Undeniable, Nye has suggested that there is something fundamentally problematic with foods containing GMO crops. He has argued that GMOs may carry environmental risks that we can never rule out with certainty. Now Nye seems to have changed his mind. Backstage, after an appearance on Bill Maher, Nye said an upcoming revision to his book would contain a rewritten chapter on GMOs. I went to Monsanto, Nye said, and I spent a lot of time with the scientists there, and I've revised my outlook, and I'm very excited about telling the world. When you're in love, you want to tell the world. So, wow. Nye's sudden about-face on GMOs might strike some people as suspicious, especially since it came after his visit. He visited a corporation, that many food and environmental activists detest, and that has particularly become synonymous with GMOs. But Nye is telling us that, irrespective of the corporation's business practices, he changed his mind after learning more about the science. Is he right? Well, here's some background information. Normally, humans would have to wait a long time for nature to create new crop varieties by natural selection. To speed things up, humans have performed artificial selection since the advent of agriculture some 10,000 years ago. Most commonly, humans have crossbred plants with the most desirable traits over and over and over again. Today, however, humans can skip the crossbreeding process in many cases. In genetic modification, scientists insert new genes directly into plants' DNA. In some cases, we've given crops genes from totally different species. The process might not sound wholesome or natural, and that's one of the concerns Nye has raised. In his book, Undeniable, he suggests we should stop introducing genes from other species into crops, largely because we just can't quite know what will happen to other species if in that modified organism's ecosystem. Essentially, Nye suggested we can't cut out the possibility of harm with certainty. The mere fact that something is a GMO doesn't tell us all that much. However, about how the plant actually functions, rather, the way a GMO plant works stems from the new genes and traits themselves, whether they were inserted by scientists or came from the same species. So scientists assess GMO safety based on whether they're GMO, but on what their new genes actually do and the resulting changes in the plants. And since GMOs cover such a wide range of traits, we have to assess them one by one. Although technically it's not mandatory to test GMOs for human health risks before they hit the marketplace in the United States, all current crops sold here have undergone voluntary review to test for potential toxins and allergens. Over the years, as peer-reviewed scientific studies on GMOs have piled up, scientific organizations ranging from the National Academy of Sciences to the World Health Organization have analyzed them and reached similar conclusions. GMOs on the market today are no riskier for your health than their non-GMO equivalents. A recent analysis of the scientific literature also found that GMO crops haven't been worse for the environment than their non-GMO counterparts, and in some cases have been better, for instance, by reducing pesticide use. That finding echoes a 2010 NAS report that GMO crops, genetically speaking, have had fewer adverse effects on the environment than non-GE crops produced conventionally. Those studies still might not have satisfied Nye. More and more of these studies and assessments could continue to pile up for decades. But just the mere possibility of an environmental impact in his view, seems to have justified stopping GMOs. Nothing in science is ever 100% certain, however. For instance, we can't be sure that our conventional and even organic crops are 100% safe either. In theory, any crop, whether the result of crossbreeding or genetic modification or even mutagenesis, that long used to create non-GMO crops such as rice and lettuce by exposing plants to DNA, altering chemicals or radiation, carries the risk of harming human health or surrounding ecosystems. That all explains why Nye has found himself in especially hot water with scientists over GMOs. As University of Florida plant scientist Kevin Folta recently argued, Nye was being hypocritical. Your logic and reasoning match the fallacies of climate and evolution deniers, the people you correctly criticize. I'm not saying GMOs are a silver bullet to end world hunger, or that I love Monsanto, and I'm not saying that there are cases where individual GMOs might result in environmental issues such as pest resistance. Debating GMOs' benefits and risks is healthy, but making GMOs the boogeyman while giving other crops a pass really isn't. You're listening to Worldwise. I'm DJ Scrappy here on radio.dominican.edu. And we'll be right back with another story about the first human and how they were just discovered in Ethiopia. So come on back. We're just going to take a little break. And after we talk about the new humans that we just found, we will move on to 9 steps in how to create our human-made world, or our era of infrastructure expansion. Then we'll move on to how marijuana can trigger psychotic symptoms for some, but scientists are trying to find out if those symptoms last. And yeah, a little bit more after that. So stay with us here on Worldwise. This is DJ Scrappy. You're listening to radio.dominican.edu. All right, welcome back to Worldwise. This is DJ Scrappy. You're on radio.dominican.edu. If you're just joining us, we have a story here from the BBC's science correspondent, Paleb Gouche, about the first human ever discovered in Ethiopia. So the 2.8 million-year-old specimen is 400,000 years older than researchers thought that our kind first emerged. So that's 500,000 years further than they thought. The discovery in Ethiopia suggests climate change spurred the transition from tree dweller to upright walker. The head of the research team told BBC News that the find gives the first insight into the most important transitions in human history. Professor Brian Villamore of the University of Nevada in Las Vegas said, "The discovery makes a clear link between an iconic 3.2 million-year-old hominin discovered in the same area in 1974 called Lucy. Could Lucy's kind, which belonged to the species Australopithecus afarensis, have evolved into the very first primitive humans?" "Well, that's what we are arguing," said Professor Villamore. "But the fossil record between the first period when Lucy and her kin were alive and the emergence of Homo erectus, with its relatively large brain and human-like body proportions 2 million years ago, is sparse. The 2.8 million-year-old lower jawbone was found in the Lidu-Garawu research area, a far regional state, by Ethiopian student Chalachu Seyum. He told BBC News that he was stunned when he saw the fossil. "The moment I found it, I realized that it was important, as this is the time period represented by few fossils in eastern Africa." The fossil is of the left side of the lower jaw, along with five teeth. The back molar teeth are smaller than those of other hominins living in the area, and are one of the features that distinguish humans from more primitive ancestors, according to Professor William Kimball, director of Arizona State University's Institute of Human Origins. Previously, the oldest fossil attributed to the genus Homo was an upper jaw from Hadar, Ethiopia, dated 2.35 million years ago, he told BBC News. "So this new discovery pushes the human line back by 400,000 years or so, very close to its likely pre-human ancestor. It's a mix of primitive and advanced features, makes the Ledi jaw a good transitional form between Lucy and later humans." So I guess from here on out, this fossil will be known as the Ledi jaw. "A computer reconstruction of a skull belonging to the species Homo habilis, which has been published in Nature Journal, indicates that it may well have been the evolutionary descendant of the species announced today." oh no, where'd I go? Sorry guys, we're just having a little bit of technical difficulties. You're listening to Dominican, or radio.dominican.edu, to a program called Worldwise with your host, DJ Scrappy, here. Climate change and how it's spurred evolution among the first humans. The dating of the jawbone might help answer one of the key questions in human evolution: what caused some primitive ancestors to climb down from trees and make their homes on the ground? A separate study in Science hints that a change in climate might have been a factor. An analysis of the fossilized plant and animal life in the area suggests that what had once been a lush forest had become dry grassland. As the trees made way for vast plains, ancient human-like primates found a way of exploiting the new environmental niche, developing bigger brains and becoming less reliant on having big jaws and teeth by using tools. Professor Chris Stringer of the Natural History Museum in London described the discovery as a big story. He says the new species clearly does show the earliest step toward human characteristics, but suggests that half a jawbone is not enough to tell just how human it was, and does not provide enough evidence to suggest that it was this line that led to us. He notes that the emergence of a human-like characteristics was not unique to Ethiopia. The human-like features shown on Australopithecus sediba in South Africa at around 1.95 million years ago are likely to have developed independently of the processes which produced humans in East Africa. Showing that parallel origins are a distinct possibility, Professor Stringer explained, this would suggest several different species of humans coexisting in Africa around 2 million years ago, with only one of them surviving and eventually evolving into our species, Homo sapiens. It is as if nature was experimenting with different versions of the same evolutionary configuration until one succeeded. Professor Stringer added, these new studies leave us with an even more complex picture of early humans than we thought, and they are challenging us to consider the very definition of what it is to be human. Are we defined by our small teeth and jaws, our larger brain, our long legs, tool making, or some combination of these traits? So there's more than one human ancestor, it looks like. Or it could be a combination of several that came together to form us. Anyways, you're listening to Worldwise. I'm DJ Scrappy here on radio.dominican.edu. Worldwise is a show about science, technology, and the environment. And we'll be right back with you with some more news. Welcome back to Worldwise. This is DJ Scrappy, and you're on radio.dominican.edu. So we have a little bit less than 10 minutes left in our broadcast, so I'm going to have to cut a few of our stories. Shout out to my instructors for making sure I have enough stories. Nine steps to survive the most explosive era of infrastructure expansion in human history, i.e., today. So, a team of scientists have called attention to nine issues that must be considered if there is to be any hope of limiting the environmental impacts of the ongoing expansion of new roads, road improvements, energy projects that are now underway or coming soon in countries all around the world. As we know, most of the world is developing, and if they start churning out pollution on our scale, it's just not going to be sustainable. And the way that we do business today needs to change too. So our world is being developed at an unprecedented pace, and the incredible expansion of infrastructure associated with all of this progress comes at a great cost to wild places and wildlife. Now a team of scientists writing in the Cell Press journal Current Biology on March 5th, call attention to nine issues that must be considered if there is to be any hope of limiting the environmental impacts of the ongoing expansion of new roads and road improvements, energy projects, and more of that stuff. We are living in the most explosive era of infrastructure expansion in human history, wrote William Lawrence of Australia's James Cook University and his colleagues. By mid-century, it is expected that there will be 25 million kilometers of new paved roads globally, enough to encircle the Earth more than 600 times. Nine-tenths of these new roads will be in developing nations, which sustain many of the planet's most biologically rich and environmentally important ecosystems. The new paper is the foundation for a major effort by scientists, environmental activists, and celebrities to lobby leaders of the G20 nations, the 20th wealthiest nations on Earth, following their announcement of plans to invest between $60 and $70 trillion in new infrastructure globally by 2030. The plan would more than double the global investment in new roads, dams, power lines, gas lines, and other energy infrastructure. Unless managed with extreme care, it would be an environmental disaster wrapped in a catastrophe, Lawrence says of the proposal. This research is a seminal effort, and it's going to have a huge impact in policy circles, says Randy Hayes, director of Foundation Earth in Washington, D.C. The fight for a better world will not be easy, but this analysis gives us concrete actions and strategies for reducing the impacts of this global tsunami of new infrastructure. Hayes and his associates plan to release a statement to G20 leaders on March 6th, the day after the paper by Lawrence and his colleagues is published online, which happens to also be today. The researchers emphasize that the threat to wild places is even more serious when illegal development activities are considered in addition to those that are officially sanctioned. In the Brazilian Amazon, for instance, there are three times more illegal roads than there are legal roads. Roads that penetrate into wilderness areas often have particularly serious effects, often opening a Pandora's box of environmental problems, such as promoting habitat conversion and fragmentation, poaching, illegal mining, wildfires, and land speculation, the researcher says. Projects such as hydroelectric dams and mines come with their own inherent problems. They typically also bring with them more new roads or road upgrades, both of which present challenges to wildlife. Lawrence and his colleagues from the Netherlands and the United Kingdom and the United States raise 9 points for addressing these challenges. So, number one, wilderness areas should be kept road-free, according to the maxim, avoid the first cut. Narrow cuts through forested areas have a tendency to grow. So when you put in a road, it tends to sprout roads right off of it and just cut through everything. Number two, the consequences of efforts to pave existing roads should be recognized. Paved roads mean easier year-round access to wilderness areas and faster speeds that put wildlife at greater risk. Number three, secondary effects of projects, including energy and mining efforts, are often worse than the project itself. Environmental impact assessments, EIAs, must include direct and indirect effects in their cost-benefit analysis. So that would probably go towards projects like mining, for instance. Number four, greater emphasis should be placed on so-called offshore projects, which might be deep in wilderness areas, but don't require the construction of new road networks. So, kind of like an oil platform, except on land, you'd have to use maybe rivers or helicopters to get to it, get to the construction site. Anyways, moving on to number five, lenders and their involved parties should get engaged in projects early, when plans can be more easily shaped or canceled altogether. Number six, better tools are needed to enable financial institutions and others to more effectively evaluate the environmental and social consequences of development projects. And number seven, financial institutions must also enlist those with the appropriate environmental and social expertise on their teams. Projects with obvious harms should not proceed for fear that if the bank doesn't do it, then someone less scrupulous will. The scientists refer to this as the devil you know dilemma. And then finally, number nine, greater involvement from representatives of non-governmental organizations and the public should be sought, especially from those who are likely to be most directly affected. So the bottom line here is that the experts say this: the veritable explosion of roads and other infrastructure globally is causing great environmental harm. It is therefore vital that those involved in evaluating, promoting, and funding such projects engage not just with those who stand to gain from such projects, but also with those who stand to lose. So just a roadmap going forward as we continue to build. All right, well, that's all I have for you today on Worldwise. You have been listening to radio.dominican.edu. I am your host, DJ Scrabby. It has been an exciting and enjoyable hour with you guys, and I'm glad to have learned a lot. I hope you are too. Join me next Friday at 11 a.m., and I will have more on science, technology, and the environment here for you on Worldwise at radio.dominican.edu. That's it for me. This is DJ Scrappy signing out.
Tell me the words I never said.